Hello, today is Thursday, November 1st, 2018. I'm Joe Schmidt with DC2, and this is Staying Connected. I'm joined today by my colleagues, Teresa Knudsen and Julie Gardner, leaders of DC2's contract compliance and optimization practice. We are going to talk about the challenges faced by enterprise users when trying to resolve billing errors with their service providers. Also, as a bonus, we'll reveal a hidden opportunity that most companies overlook. Teresa and Julie, thanks for joining me. And Teresa, let me start with you. Can you discuss some of the challenges that enterprise users face when trying to resolve billing errors with their service providers?
Sure, and thanks, Joe. I guess this is a topic that both Julie and I have been dealing with now for over 20 years. And historically, billing issues typically took no more than 3 to 4 months to resolve, and they were handled directly by your assigned account team, which was great, because in those days, your account teams were often fully dedicated, if not partially dedicated, to you, depending on your spend level. And the account team knew you, they knew your company, and most importantly, they knew your contract terms and conditions.
Yeah, and so while historically that 3 to 4 months was what most of our clients saw, now we're seeing that time frame grow from anywhere from 6 months to up to 2 years, sometimes even longer, depending on the size and the nature of the issue that's in dispute. And more complex issues clearly take longer. But the time frame is lengthened due to the carriers requiring multiple approval levels before anything can be resolved, especially if you have issues that are of significant size.
Yeah, I think it's actually kind of interesting because it's like running a gauntlet to get a dispute resolved. There's often challenges one after another, and you really never know what those challenges are going to be, and they often change. For example, Verizon has a review committee that specifically looks at credits that are between $100,000 and $250,000. They have a separate committee called the CRC, or Credit Review Committee, that reviews any credits that are above $250,000. And what's really funny is that the lower level credit review committee can basically punt an issue up to the higher level committee if they feel like it's warranted. So you never really know which specific committee is going to review and approve those. And once you get an issue through the credit review committee, then the same issue has to go through Verizon's finance department. So it's like this ever-changing gauntlet to go through in order to get something approved.
And AT&T has a similar process based on the nature of the credit request. AT&T classifies your credit requests into 3 different buckets, one being what they would call a contract credit, a correct charge credit, or an efficiency credit. And each of those 3 buckets has a specific approval process based on the dollars involved. In fact, AT&T's customer billing reps have a documented checklist with specific suggestions on how that rep is supposed to handle each claim based on the type of claim. And there are comments on that checklist that say, did you attempt to sustain it, meaning did you try to deny it? Is there a risk of legal action from the customer? Would the customer move business? How much do they spend? Do they have a history of these types of disputes? So it's not at all what you would call customer friendly. And clearly, you've got competing objectives. You want to get money back, and they don't want to provide those credits if they don't have to. But once you get your claim through customer care, and it makes its way through this 4-page checklist, it's then subject to those additional approvals, similar to what Teresa outlined for Verizon, meaning the dollar values, as they increase, there's an additional layer of approval needed before AT&T will approve the credit and ultimately it will get processed back to you.
So what else has changed about raising disputes? It sounds to me like a simple email to your account team just doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Joe. The process to raise a dispute really has changed fairly dramatically. In the past, you'd just email your account rep. You know, you might have a conversation. You'd follow up with an email that would say, hey, my billing on this account, we think it's wrong for these reasons. Your account rep would then take that, run with it, work the dispute, and get you the credit back. These days, with the stripping down of the account team support structure, most of our clients have to raise their billing disputes via the carrier portals themselves. When you do that, you get assigned a random billing person who doesn't know your company's spend or your company's specific contract, and perhaps not even the details of your claim. If it's a more complex claim, sometimes they're a little bit harder to follow. And hopefully, once you've documented this dispute, you'll get a reference number for it. In the AT&T world, it's called an RDS, and in the Verizon world, it's called an INQ. But that reference number is key, as it locks down the date that you raised the dispute.
Why is documenting the date of the dispute being raised a key thing?
Well, it's interesting because once you've gotten all parties to agree that your dispute is legitimate and the error is corrected, you then have to work with the carrier to calculate the resulting credit. So the time frame that you can go back on a credit depends on your specific contract. Worst case, you can go back 6 months from the date the dispute was raised. But if you have a highly negotiated and custom contract, like the majority of our clients do, you often could go back 2 years from the date that the dispute was raised. So say it takes 8 months to resolve a billing issue once you've raised it, and your contract allows you to recover back 6 months from the initial date the dispute was raised, your resulting credit should really be for 14 months.
Right. So the date, again, is critical. It's used as the basis for all of your credit calculations. And in those credit calculations, you want to get a copy of those. You want to review it, and you want to make sure that all of the applicable taxes and regulatory surcharges have been applied to the credit. That's very significant these days with USF now at 20.1% for the fourth quarter of 2018. That means a USF contributory service like, say, Ethernet access would be subject to 30% or more once you add in the USF, the other regulatory fees and taxes. So when you get your credit calculation, you need to understand if the underlying service is USF contributory, and then if it is, making sure that you have the appropriate credits for those taxes and regulatory fees is really critical. I recently worked on a credit for Ethernet access, and the carrier applied the credit to a bill payer that included a lot of PTT access and MPLS ports. They applied the underlying account's tax rate for surcharges and regulatory fees and taxes to the credit, and it was about 6%. What we found is that the services in question, obviously all Ethernet access, should have been subject to more like a 33% pickup, and that resulted in an increase in the credit of about $80,000. So it is significant, and it's something that you want to make sure that you look for in all of your credit calculations.
Yeah, and it's really interesting is that most suppliers allow you to select the account to which you want a credit to post. So knowing your account profiles, knowing the accounts that have the highest taxes and regulatory fees is key. So you, when asked that question, you can direct the supplier to the account that has the biggest benefit for you.
Right. And documentation, again, anytime you're raising a dispute, make sure you keep a record of all of your emails and your dates and supporting contractual language in a specific place, because you'll need to provide this again and again. Ideally, you're going to attach the underlying contract to your claim with the carrier, but really making sure that you keep a spreadsheet, you document that number, that RDS or INQ number for an AT&T or Verizon customer, the date you filed it, and then track the correspondence that you received back and forth. It's critical in making sure that ultimately you get the credit that you're due.
Okay, so as I teased in the opening, the two of you have identified a savings opportunity that's often overlooked by enterprises. What is it?
Yeah, it's interesting because Julie and I both ran into this kind of unique occurrence during the past 6 months, and it's really worthy of a discussion. So whether or not you have a TEM provider processing your bills, there can be a situation where an invoice has an unapplied credit on it. And you can identify these situations when you look at an invoice and say you see the current charges are $50,000, but the total due on the account is something less, like say $10,000. So oftentimes the default accounts payable process is simply to pay current charges each month. And so this can lead to situations where companies aren't fully utilizing credits that are available and just sitting on accounts and posted and just waiting for you to take advantage of them. So over the summer, I helped a Fortune 500 company transition from one global TEM supplier to another. And during the course of the transition, I had all the invoices come across my desk. And upon the review, we found over $500,000 in unapplied credits just sitting there. So the TEM provider was simply paying current charges. They weren't highlighting to this customer of theirs that there were these unapplied credits available. So again, to identify, just look for any invoices where current charges are more than the total due on the account.
Great point, Teresa. And really, you don't just need to look for this when you're doing a TEM transition. I was recently doing an RFP rate implementation audit, and part of that audit, I needed to pull invoices. As I was going through the invoices, I'm flipping through these statements of account, which can be 10, 15 pages long, and I noticed just a whole ton of credits that were out on the account. So we went back to the carrier and asked for a list of unapplied credits, and my client and I were shocked to see a seven-figure number sitting out there across a bunch of accounts that had not been applied. And so my client took that information, went back to its TEM and said, okay, I want to see all unapplied credits across all accounts. And again, we got a very lengthy list that was quite surprising. And it's exactly, you know, for the reasons that Teresa outlined, and it is that the TEM was paying the current amount due. and not necessarily looking through that statement of account or those credits that may be posted below the line next to the payments. And as a result, these large, in some cases, and in some cases not so large, credits were sitting out on accounts, even closed accounts. So in years past, perhaps the carriers were issuing checks on ILEC, CLEC, and some accounts that were closed. Now it appears as if the carriers are sitting on those credit balances, and you're not going to get them back unless you request for them to be applied to other accounts. So I also want to highlight that not only is it applicable to your inter-exchange accounts, but really making sure that you look at your ILEC and CLEC accounts, because local service accounts have seen some pretty significant declines in spend as most companies are migrating to SIP, and these are often overlooked, so you can end up with some pretty significant credits sitting out there on those ILEC and CLEC accounts that you may not be paying attention to, and again, you're not going to get those credits unless you ask for them from your carriers.
That's amazing, and it does sound like a pretty easy opportunity for these enterprise customers of ours. Okay, we are about out of time. Do the two of you have any final advice?
I have a good one, and I suggest this for all my clients, is that create an agenda topic in your normal monthly vendor meetings to discuss outstanding billing issues that are over a certain threshold of dollars or length of time that have been in dispute. So say anything that's been outstanding more than 3 months, or say in your situation, say $50,000, so that you continue to get the right visibility of aging of issues. And then use your next competitive procurement or RFP to address this ever-lengthening time frame it takes to get things resolved. Seek for a set period of time before contractual escalation procedures are available to you. And the best practice is that you have a right to offset disputed amounts from payment after a certain period. 3 months is probably best in class.
And so most of our clients don't elect to offset the disputed amounts just due to tracking complexities. You start deducting from your payments. It can become a little bit of a AP nightmare. It's always an option. Really, the ability to use your account team as an escalation point when a dispute is unresolved for some period of time, as Teresa said, 3 months is a best practice. But the ability to use that account team for escalation after that 3-month mark is really critical. More complex disputes are going to take a longer time to resolve. However, they should still be part of that 3-month escalation process. And while no one wants to bring legal into the mix, it can happen. So make sure that you have your legal resources on board if a situation warrants it. And that's typically only when you've got pushback after you've requested escalation and you're seeing a pattern where you have an issue and the carrier's not willing to escalate or not willing to pursue the claim on your behalf.
Yeah, and I agree with Julie. In dealing with these types of issues over the years, we typically have our clients pay the invoices and work to resolve the issue after the fact. So that works when you have an ongoing relationship with a supplier. But say you're exiting a relationship with a supplier and you have some disputed amounts, definitely use that short pay or offset amount, as it's really tough to get refund checks from anyone these days. And in my experience, I've only had a handful of billing issues that have required legal intervention over my 20 years, and I've regularly had big issues in front of the credit review committees of both carriers. So there's a way to work the issues, but just know it'll take time and patience.
Okay. Thank you, Teresa, and thank you as well, Julie. As you and the listening audience just heard, it's probably worthwhile looking at your carrier billing dispute process. And of course, if you need some help, Teresa and Julie are ready to assist. You can also contact any of us or any of our TC2 and LB3 colleagues if you have other ICT lifecycle needs. And of course, you can always stay current by checking out our websites or follow us on LinkedIn.